Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. The following show is a speech that Matt Savinar gave at the Titanic Lifeboat Conference in Astoria, Oregon in June 2005.
Everything I'm going to talk about today is on my site, so I have everything linked up to the original source, so you don't have to rely on my word for it. You can actually go to the original people. That's probably one of the strengths of the site and why it's been so effective is you go to the original document and check it out for yourself. So first I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Matt Savinar. I operate a website called lifeafterthoilcrash.net. You can also go to oiltruth.com and get. And I'm the author of a book, The Oil Age is Over, What to Expect as the World Runs Out of Cheap Oil, 2005 to 2050. I graduated law school 2 years ago, took the bar, moved back home, and then I was doing some research about the drug war. That was my main area of concern at that point in my life. The war on drugs is, I probably don't need to tell you guys, it's total BS. And I was pretty concerned about it, and I still am. And of course, when you begin to look into narcotics and oil overlap an awful lot. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit. And I came across Mike Rupert's site from the wilderness. And I knew, I was actually amazed that I had not come across the site before. And I could tell, I'm like, okay, well, this guy knows what he's talking about when it comes to how drug money works. And I noticed all these articles on oil. And I knew at that point, I'm like, well, yeah, oil is important. We're probably in Iraq for oil, you know, obviously. And if what he's saying is true about all this stuff, we're in really, really deep stuff. And I did what most people do when they first hear about peak oil. You read a little bit, a little bit, and a little bit more, and you get progressively more disturbed. And so finally the light bulb went off, or they got the feeling in the gut. I was like, oh, wow, this is really big. I didn't really know what to do, so I put up my site, just figuring maybe I'd use it to meet other people who are concerned about the issue. And if I make it comprehensive, I don't have to constantly re-explain why hydrogen isn't going to save our butts, you know, why zero-point energy isn't going to do the trick, so on and so forth. Next thing I know, the site's getting 10,000 visits a day. I'm getting invited on radio shows, and it just has mushroomed from there. Okay, so what is peak oil? All oil production follows a bell curve. This is true whether we're talking about an individual field, a particular oil-producing country, or the world as a whole. Okay, now we've been going up the upslope of the global oil production curve since 1859, when the first commercial oil well was drilled. So what happens? Oil production goes up, then it reaches a plateau, commonly referred to as a peak, and then it goes down. Now, if you look at the individual bell curves for certain nations or certain fields, the bell curve will not always look perfect. You know, if there's a war, production might drop or it might go up. If there's political disruptions, you may get similar effects. So if you look at individual countries, the bell curve will look kind of funky. Soviet Union, for instance, they have a bell curve that's got two bell curves inside of one bell curve. But the global aggregate comes out to look like a curve. Okay. And so at some point, production peaks, and then you go down the backside of the bell curve. And as you go down the backside, the oil becomes increasingly expensive, both financially and energetically, to pull out of the ground. Okay, now at some point, about halfway down the backside of the bell curve, you have to put in more energy than the oil actually contains. This is called energy return on energy invested. Now, oil used to have an EROEI of about 30. You'd invest one barrel of oil, you get back 30 barrels. Depending on where you go, what part of the world, and whose statistics you rely on, that number's down between 5 and 10. Now, like I said, when you get to about halfway down the backside, it ceases to break even, which means at that point, oil is no longer of use as an energy source, because you got to invest more than you're getting back. It'd be like going to the bank, giving them a dollar to get back 80 cents. It doesn't make any sense. Or example I use, it'd be like if apples were your primary food source, apples got, say, 50 calories. You spent 60 calories to climb up the tree to pick a 50-calorie apple. Well, you're going to be losing weight. So now the exact date as to when we peak, nobody knows for sure. Probably won't know till after the fact. The United States, single biggest geopolitical event in the last 100 years, maybe even the last 200 or ever since the industrial age began, was our production peaked in October 1970. Peak oil is also known as Hubbard's Curve, named for Dr. M. King Hubbard. In 1956, he predicted U.S. production will peak 1970, 1971. He turned out to be right. Folks laughed at him at that point, said this is never going to happen. And if you look at the production and discovery curves from back in the 50s, we were discovering 30 billion barrels a year. We were only using 6 billion barrels a year. So you can understand why people thought he was crazy. We were discovering so much more than we were using. How could we ever possibly peak or run out? But he turned out to be correct. He predicted that global production would peak in 1995. So he was off by about 10 years. And if I had more time, I could go into why he was off. But that's not really relevant, since most of you already believe that we are peaking and the peak is imminent. We may already be in it, in what's called the petroleum plateau. Okay, so why is this important? Well, it's important because oil is your god. I don't care if you worship Jesus, Buddha, nature, the mother goddess, whatever. You actually worship oil because it provides virtually everything for us. All pesticides come from oil. All fertilizers come from ammonia, which comes from natural gas. Natural gas production will peak about 10 years after oil production. Natural gas production, when it peaks, it doesn't go down a bell curve like this. It falls off a cliff. Average piece of food in the U.S. travels 1,500 miles from where it's produced to where it's consumed. In Canada, that's 5,000 miles. Roads, tractors, trailers, air transport, boats, all of those are constructed, transported, and fashioned using oil. Of course, they're also powered using oil. All forms of alternative energy, solar panels, windmills, nuclear power plants, are constructed in oil. Go out and get the resources to make the solar panels, for instance. That is done with oil-powered machinery. The solar panels are constructed in an oil-powered factory. They're shipped to, you know, an oil-powered distribution point, so on and so forth. Takes about 18 barrels of oil to manufacture a ton of copper. Takes about 360 barrels of oil to manufacture a ton of aluminum. Average car consumes the energy equivalent of about 27 barrels or 1,200 gallons of oil during its construction. Average computer consumes 10 times its weight in fossil fuels during its construction. One microchip consumes 630 times its weight in fossil fuels during its construction. So 1 gram of microchips, 630 grams of fossil fuels used to construct that. Average cell phone's got 18 microchips in it. Okay, so this has implications for our use of alternative energy, because solar panels, windmills, whatever your favorite alternative is, it usually involves advanced technology. Even biodiesel, you know, biodiesel can actually be polluting if you screw up the chemicals and dump them into the ground. So they got to be produced in a factory somewhere. It's all using technology. Okay, one barrel of oil. Guess how many man or woman hours of labor are contained in one barrel of oil? It would take a human 25,000 hours of effort to produce the amount of energy in one barrel of oil. That barrel of oil, if it's pulled out of the ground in Iraq, it only takes a dollar to pull out of the ground. If it's pulled out of the ground in the U.S., it takes $10. The reason for the difference is we're way on the backside of our Hubbard's curve. Iraq is still an upslope. Saudi Arabia, it's $2.50. Global average is $5. So if you're in Iraq and you can spend $1 to pull out 25,000 hours of person power, that's a miracle. I mean, it's basically free energy. Okay, a gallon of gas, before it's converted into actual usable energy, contains about 500 hours of human labor. Okay, once you account for the conversion process, that number's cut to about 200. Okay, gallon of gas right now costs what, $2.50? So for $2.50, you're getting somewhere between 200 and 500 hours of human labor. Now, how much would you have to pay a person, even working at minimum wage, to get 200 hours or 300 or whatnot of labor? Well, $5 an hour times 200 hours, that's $1,000. I go down to the gas station and get that for $2.50. Now, all this is, if you go to my site, I've got all this linked up so you can go confirm it for yourself. People have a hard time believing this, even when they confirm it for themselves. And the link is to the research, so you can go confirm it yourselves. I've been quoted heavily in front of Congress, and this is one of the things that this congressman in Maryland, he's read virtually my entire site into the congressional record. One of the examples that he used was, I say on my site, people have a hard time believing this, even when they confirm it for themselves, but think about it this way. How long would it take you to push a 3-ton Hummer 10 miles? Okay. You put a gallon of gas in that Hummer, it'll go 10 miles in 10 minutes. Now, even Arnold, back when he was Mr. Olympia, I don't think could push a Hummer, you know, all that far. Okay, even a hybrid, they get 60 miles to the gallon. So $2.50 a gallon of gas will send that thing 60 miles, traveling at 60 miles per hour. How long would it take you to push a hybrid 60 miles? Not as long as it would take to push a Hummer, but it's still going to be a pretty long time. So that's why we've got this wonderful, you know, this very advanced complex civilization, because we've had access to such an amazing source of energy. Okay, peak oil and the financial system. Okay, a lot of people don't understand how our monetary system works. I'm going to use an example. Let's say you want to open up a computer store. Okay, well, I go to the bank. The bank gives me a loan for, just to make the math easy, $10,000. And they say, Matt, you need to pay this back plus 10% interest in 1 year. Okay, well, remember, the computers consume 10 times their weight in fossil fuels during their construction. The construction of the computer store is going to consume a certain amount of energy. The roads leading to the store, the food I eat and the food my employees eat, all of that is basically energy. So the money that they're loaning me is just a symbol for energy. Okay, so in order for me to pay back that loan, there has to be more money available in the future than there is now. Otherwise, I can't pay back the interest. Okay, in effect, what the bank has done is they said, Matt, here are a bunch of barrels of oil. Go out and do your business, and in a year, pay us back that same number of barrels of oil plus 10% extra oil. So I have to go out, by paying back my loans, I actually have to go out and create an increased demand for energy. And this is how the entire financial system works. So somebody will say, well, I'm not in any debt. I don't have to pay back interest. Okay, well, let's say you're my employee and I pay you. Even if you don't have any debt, the money that I paid you was created by the bank. It's debt-based money. So what happens, people go, wait a minute, we're only going to decline 2 or 3% per year once this gets underway, right? What's the big deal? You know, if you're living on $100,000 a year, can't you live on $97,000 a year? You know, that's the thinking that goes on. But that's not the way it works in the real world. You need a constantly increasing supply. So back in the 70s, oil shocks in the 70s were only caused by about a 5% reduction in supply. And yet we had all these problems. Now, what's going to happen when we get a 2, 3, 4% reduction per year? Well, the financial system falls apart. The financial system falls apart. You can't scale up your use of alternative energy to the degree that we would need, even if we were capable of doing it physically, when you've got a collapsing banking system. Where are you going to get all the a network of hydrogen pipelines comparable to our natural gas, our system of natural gas pipelines? That costs $200 trillion. That's on my site, linked up. You can follow and read the original article for yourself. Where are you going to come up with $200 trillion when the financial system's collapsing? Okay, so it has implications for energy and you know, everything else. How much time do I have left? Okay, I'll just keep talking until they tell me to be quiet. Dick Cheney. Now, of course, you know, Dick Cheney said American way of life is non-negotiable. He's right, though. He's absolutely right. It is non-negotiable. I can prove it to you right now. Who here is against the war in Iraq? Raise your hand. Who here owns a car? Virtually all of us kept our hands up. Okay, so you aren't willing to negotiate your way of life. So we're proving them right, unfortunately. That's one of the tough aspects of this, is when you really get into it, you get a reality check. Yeah. Okay, there's a lot of stuff I would go into if I had more time. Okay, people say, what about the oil sands and the oil sands in Canada, Venezuela, oil shale in the American West? Can't we use that? There's tons. Okay. First of all, okay, global oil discovery peaked in 1962, has gone down to really nothing now. Okay, we now consume 6 barrels for every barrel we use. Thing is, even if we, right now, we were originally endowed with 2 trillion barrels of oil. We've consumed about 1 trillion. Peak occurs at the halfway mark of the, when you've exhausted your oil endowment. Okay, so we're originally endowed with 2 trillion. We've consumed 1 trillion. That puts us right around the halfway mark. Now, surely if we found 3 trillion barrels of oil somewhere that we somehow missed, that would put the crisis off by quite a while, wouldn't it? We've only used 1 trillion in the last 150 years. So if we found 3 trillion, that would put it off a good number of years. Put it off maybe about 15. Okay, even if we found 3 trillion in the ground that we haven't discovered. And here's why. I'm going to have to step away from the microphone for just a moment. Okay, we got 2 trillion barrels. We're at the halfway mark, 1 trillion. Okay, remember, the crisis hits at the halfway mark. If there was 3 trillion barrels in the ground that we had not found before, that means there'd be originally, we'd have 4 trillion left. I'm getting the math confused here in front of the crowd. But let's say there's 4 trillion originally in the ground instead of 2 trillion, a doubling of the original endowment. Wow, that's going to put the crisis off for a while, right? No. The crisis would then hit at the 2 trillion mark instead of the 1 trillion mark. Now, how long would it take us to go from 1 trillion to 2 trillion barrels? Okay, well, right now we use about 30 billion barrels per year, the world as a whole. 30 billion into a trillion is 33. That's 33 years. Now, the thing is, because of the way the monetary system is structured, we need an extra 2 or 3 or 4% per year. When you factor that in, that 33 years shrinks down to about 15, 16. Okay, the economy doubles about every 25 years. Okay, if you want to know how fast an economy doubles, use the law of 70. Find out what your yearly rate of growth is, divide that into 70, that'll tell you how fast something doubles. So if we have the economy grows at a rate of 3.5% per year, divide that into 70, that's 20 years. Okay, so even if you found a whole new planet Earth worth of oil, it wouldn't do very much. So discovering more oil is not really an option. Now, is the oil industry aware of this? Yes. When an industry begins to contract, corporations begin to merge. It's sort of like the corporate version of cannibalism. Okay, now this whole peak oil phenomenon, the fact that it was going to happen on a global scale, people in the oil industry began to see this around 95, 96. Okay, they thought that the oil in the Caspian would put it off at least a couple years. Oil in the Caspian, they thought there was 400 up to 400 billion barrels, turned out to be about 40 billion barrels. Okay, and then, so here's what started happening. December 98, BP and Amoco merge. April 99, BP, Amoco, and ARCO agree to merge. December 99, Exxon and Mobil merge. October 2000, Chevron and Texaco agree to merge. November 2001, Phillips and Conoco agree to merge. September 2002, Shell acquires Pennzoil Quaker State. February 2003, Frontier Oil and Holly Oil merge. March 2004, Marathon acquires 40% of Ashland. April 2004, Westport Resources acquires Kerr-McGee. April 2005, Chevron, Texaco, and Unocal merge. Okay, so they clearly know what's going on. These are the actions of an industry that's contracting, not expanding. Okay, is Bush and Cheney aware of it? Yeah. Dick Cheney in 1999, when he was still president of CEO of Halliburton, here's his quote. By some estimates, there will be an average 2% annual growth in global oil demand over the years ahead, along with conservatively a 3% natural decline in production from existing reserves. That means by 2010, we will need on the order of an additional 50 million barrels a day. We use about, right now, 83 million barrels a day. There's no way we're getting an extra 50 million barrels a day. That's just, it's ludicrous. So that's basically an admission of peak oil, because anybody who knows anything about the oil industry knows we're not, an extra 50 million barrels a day is just insane. Here's a report commissioned by Cheney in 2001. This is when he's vice president. Most significant difference between now and a decade ago is the extraordinary rapid erosion of spare capacities at critical segments of energy chains. Today, shortfalls appear to be endemic. Among the most extraordinary of these losses is spare capacity in the oil arena. The report went on to say, a reassessment of the role of energy in American foreign policy is necessary. That means we're going to war. Okay. Matt Simmons, who has advised Bush and Cheney on energy issues. This is what he said in 2003 when he was interviewed by Mike Rupert. Mike asked him, is it time for this to become part of the public debate? And Matt Simmons responded, it's past time. As I've said, the experts and politicians have no plan B to fall back on. If energy peaks, particularly while 5 of the world's 6.5 billion people have little or no use of modern energy, it'll be a tremendous jolt to our economic well-being and to our health greater than anyone could ever imagine. When asked if there's a solution, he responded, I don't think there is one. The solution is to pray. Under the best of circumstances, if all prayers are answered, there will be no crisis for maybe 2 years. After that's a certainty. Okay, there's a report prepared for the Department of Energy just a couple months ago about peak oil mitigating the risks, or something along those lines. It's linked up on my site. You can go read the original report. Problems associated with world oil production peaking will not be temporary, and past energy crisis experience will provide relatively little guidance. The challenge of oil peaking deserves immediate, serious attention. If risks are to be fully understood, mitigation begun on a timely basis. The world has never faced a problem like this. Without massive mitigation more than a decade before the fact, the problem will be pervasive and will not be temporary. Previous energy transitions were gradual and evolutionary. Oil picking would be abrupt and revolutionary. Okay, waiting for the market. Now, this is what you hear from a lot of people. They say, well, the price will go up, and then the market laws of supply and demand, the God that is the invisible hand that we all worship will fix everything magically. Well, what they forget, okay, so let's say the amount of energy contained in a barrel of oil, if you were to get that from renewable resources, it would cost between $100 and $250 per barrel. That's not even accounting for the fact that you have to build an entire new generation of cars, of pipelines, of everything to tap whatever sources of energy we're going to use. Okay, what that means is that energy companies aren't going to be motivated to aggressively pursue these other sources until oil is somewhere between $100 and $250 a barrel. You get oil at $150, $200 a barrel, our economy will collapse, okay? Because we will not be able to sustain our debt with that amount when we have to spend that much more on energy. So the market won't react until it's too late. Okay, by the time we're motivated, the game's over. Okay, then you also get the factor of the bidders on Wall Street. Okay, when you hear about the price, what the price of oil is, a lot of that has to do with speculation on the market. Now, once the bidders wake up to this, they'll bid the price up to Lord knows what, because they will realize, well, we're in a stage of permanent oil scarcity. The bidders on Wall Street are only concerned about short-term profits. You wonder, why haven't they started to do this? This information is coming out. It's because they're really only concerned about what's happening in the immediate foreseeable future. Now, when we get to a point when on the global scale, we have what happened to the U.S. in the early 70s, where production has dropped for two or three consecutive years, it will then become obvious what's going on. The Arab oil embargo of 1973, one of the reasons they hit us with that is our production had been declining since 1970. So after two or three years of that, we couldn't just say, oh, it's just the weather, or we didn't make the right investment. It was obvious what was going on. So then they hit us with the embargo, and many of you probably remember that. So once that happens on the global scale, you see the price bid up really high. There's a French bank that just said they wouldn't be surprised to see $380 oil. Just to give you perspective, that would put gas at about $15 a gallon. Okay, now let me ask you, if you had to pay $10 or even $7 a gallon for gas, how are you going to manage to also afford solar panels for your house? You're probably not going to be able to. Now, that phenomenon is going to happen on the national scale. We're not going to be able to afford to scale up these renewables to the scale that we need when we're spending all this money just to keep things cobbled together. Now, I'm going to talk about the alternatives in just a moment. But before I do that, I have to talk about drug money, because this ties into oil. This is the economy. Oil goes in one way, garbage comes out the other. So why efficiency doesn't actually make the situation any better. If we go inside this machine and remove its internal inefficiencies, the extra energy, the extra oil, just gets put back into the machine. So it just ends up consuming oil and spitting out garbage even faster. It's like, let's say you own a business. Let's say we go back to the computer store example. And you learn about peak oil, you're like, well, we need to start saving energy. So you install insulation, your employees wear sweaters or whatever, you do all the usual steps that people take. Let's say you save $500 a month on your energy costs. Well, what are you going to do with that $500? You're either going to reinvest it in the business, maybe take out advertising or hire more people or whatnot. Then you're going to sell more computers. Well, computers consume 10 times their weight in fossil fuels during the construction. So you're going to be selling more. People say, well, what if I just deposit the money in the bank? Well, the bank will loan out about $6 for every dollar that you deposit. Those loans will go to people to buy computers and cars and build roads and so on and so forth. So we've got a system that whatever we do just makes the system more efficient. Actually, the economy in the last 30 years is a good example of that. It now takes half as much oil to produce a dollar of GDP as it did 30 years ago. But our consumption, or I should say, our consumption is twice as high. Okay, this is known as Jevons paradox. Conservation will benefit you as an individual. My company will be more profitable. I might be able to roll some of the money I save into solar panels or taking permaculture classes or whatever. But as a national strategy, it just speeds everything up. Alternatives, they're very worthwhile. We should be investing in them, but we can't expect them to save our butts. The thing that lubes this whole thing up is drug money. Okay, the U.S. Department of Justice tells us that about $100 million per year narcotic money comes in the U.S. economy. Less biased estimates, Mike Rupert, Catherine Austin Fitz, put that number at 500 billion to a trillion. Again, every dollar that comes in creates $6 to $12 in cash transactions. I mean, nobody knows the exact number because it's drug money and it's hard to track, but it's an absolutely huge number. The U.S. economy is about $10 or $11 trillion economy per year. So if you've got, a trillion dollars coming in drug money, our entire economy is based on drugs and petrodollars. Thing is, everything that we have, our medicine, food, is dependent on hyper-militaristic foreign policy because the dollar is a reserve currency for oil. If you want to buy oil in the world, you got to pay in dollars. Now, what happens if somebody tries to pay in something else like euros? Well, that's what Saddam tried to do. So basically, if I had more time, I use an example where I break the room up into groups and I hand out bread and I have somebody come up and I have them be my enforcer. And if somebody tries to switch, you know, from Savinars to whatever else they want to pay in, tell my enforcer, go kill that person. And it's just an exercise to get people to understand. Now, why would you invest in the dollar? Why would you invest in the U.S. if we didn't have the petrodollar? There wouldn't really be much reason left to invest in us. You know, it wouldn't be because of our fantastically great leadership. So what we've got is oil and the military. Petrodollar is backed up by military force. So again, this is for those of us who are progressives or whatnot. It's kind of a gut check. You know, we're dependent on the things that we oppose. Now, the thing with the drug money, you can't have a system that's just dependent on a constantly increasing amount of oil, which we need to have military force to make sure that it's paid in dollars, and on drug money, and expect the system to kind of keep hobbling along by hooking it up to some solar panels. A system like this is bound to fall apart at some point. You can go on my site. I go through every single alternative and why even a combination of all of them aren't going to save our butts. Couple quick examples. Solar. Okay, you could take all of the solar panels in the world, add them all up, you get the equivalent of two coal-fired gas electricity plants. Alternatives cannot come anywhere close to competing with oil in terms of energy density. They're not liquid forms of energy. You'd have to rebuild our entire automotive fleet, our entire air fleet, boats, everything runs on this stuff. You can't run a car or a boat on solar or wind. Okay, you can convert the solar or wind to hydrogen, but then that creates a whole other set of problems. You have to have a system to distribute the hydrogen. Cost up to $200 trillion. Hydrogen fuel cell cars cost right now $1 million. Enough platinum to even come close to building the number of fuel cell cars that we would need. Driving, period, is on the way out. You know, it's going to be bicycle is the transportation of the future. Assuming we can get the rubber from, well, most of the rubber is all imported. Yeah, ball bearings. See, that's the thing is when you really get into this, it gets pretty mind-blowing. But yeah, if we can have enough land to feed them, that's another problem. We're running out of arable land just to feed everybody, let alone to scale up the use of ethanol or biodiesel or whatnot. If I had more time, I'd cover all these miracles that are supposed to save us, like thermal depolymerization, which is basically trying to solve a famine by eating your own feces. Now, it's a gross example, but in both cases, the Energy Star Party is trying to recycle some of its thinking, using some of its waste and plugging that back into the system is going to solve the problem. Space-based solar arrays, algae-derived biodiesel, 0 point. Basically, may as well be waiting for the rapture if you're waiting for these things to save our butts. I got a list of things on the site, too, that you can do to prepare. That's what this whole weekend is about.